Hello, my name is Em. I am an adult child. I am learning to be my own loving parent one day at a time. And I'd like to just start with just a couple breaths. Ground, call in my higher power. Well, I'm very grateful to be here tonight. Thank you very much. And what I'd like to start with is the first time I did a share was here last year about this time. So it's really nice to be back. Thank you all, and thanks Terry for asking me, Terry B. Well, let's see. There's so many things to say. I think I'll just start with part of me wants to jump ahead because I'm excited. I gotta, it, well, I'll just jump ahead because it's fun and my kids want to share a little something about them. And my recovery. So as I was preparing tonight, I was just mentally and emotionally getting prepared to do this. I took a shower. And when I got out of the shower, I had a text from my second daughter saying my granddaughter wanted to FaceTime with me. And that's a huge gift for me because that same daughter, I have four kids, and I've gone through two cycles where none of them were speaking to me. Except my son sort of always kept, I have three girls and a boy, and my son always kept like a thin thread of communication, even when none of the girls were talking to me. Thank God for a son. Anyway, so when I saw the message, I got excited, of course, and I didn't know if I was going to get to catch my granddaughter because it was 20 minutes later. But I did get to talk to her, and she's 2 years old, and she's really starting to talk a lot, and it's a lot of fun to watch her grow. I feel really blessed to be a grandmother. She's my second grandbaby, and I have a new grandbaby as well. So the grandkids are always a treasure in my heart. I'm gonna jump back to kind of where I came from. Some of you know my story and some of you don't. I came from a look good family. There wasn't alcoholism in my family. There wasn't drug abuse. There wasn't physical abuse or sexual abuse. There was a lot of spiritual and emotional abuse. And it took me a really long time to even know that that was the case. I knew I disliked my mom a lot, but I didn't realize what was going on. And I'll get more into that a little bit later. But the truth is, I never felt okay to be me. Growing up in the family that I was in, my mom was very jealous of me. I had the body type she wanted. I was smart, I was creative, and really her jealousy squashed me in a way I hid. And I realized also that my father wanted a boy, not a girl. And I was the firstborn. And that was something that came as a memory in 2013 when I shaved my head baldy bald. I'd wanted to shave it since I was pregnant with my second daughter, and the family had said, "No, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it." And finally, after divorce and nobody was with me, I was like, and somebody kind of called me out on it because they'd heard me talking about it for a while, and she was like, "What's up?" And I was just like, "It's time." And I did it. And in that time, I remembered my first moment of life, and I floated along the ceiling with the doctor to go tell my dad, "Congratulations, you have a new baby girl." And I remember him telling that to my dad, and my dad just melting in devastation. And what I didn't know until years later was that the first time my dad held me all of that went away. He was just in awe and gratitude and pure love. But I didn't know that really until I guess it was 2016 when that memory came. Anyhow, growing up, I just didn't feel okay in my own skin. I was numb, I was shut down. I didn't feel like I had any space to be. When I tried to be who I am, I got shut down. And actually, recently I realized something else. I realized that I was pretty awake spiritually and saw things and felt things and was very aware. And I shut all that down too. And so the metaphysical world, the new age world, the connection to higher power was something that I was born with very strongly. And because of the lack of acceptance of my parents for me to be me, all that got shut down too. And even now, I have a lot of fear of bringing those parts of myself out. My mom was super controlling. Everything was her way or the highway. And my dad was super codependent. He let her do everything. He really, to this day, has had no life outside of my mom. His only hobbies are traveling and art and football. So really, he lives his life through the TV and lives vicariously through others. He never even really had a career. He worked some through the years, but it was my mom that was the main breadwinner. My mom did everything. She was the breadwinner. She took care of the home and the kids and was of service to everyone in the community. In her community, she was major overfunctioner. So that was kind of family life. I have one sister, and she and my mom were in cahoots to the end. I was the family scapegoat. My sister does not speak to me, and that's okay with me right now. Moved out of the house at 18, was like never going back. I'm like, oh no, I'm never going back. And that changed a few years ago. I did end up going home, but I'll get back to that in a little while. I completely wrecked college, my first year of college, and it was the first time I had any freedom to make any choices on my own. Living with a controlling mother, I had very strict, very tight boundaries and was told what to do with every moment of my life. And so when I got to college and I had free will, making good choices was a little difficult in relation to school. But they thought I was partying, and I wasn't partying because I'd partied at home. And there was no challenge in partying at school because drinking was legal in New Orleans when I was there. And I was just more curious about trying to figure out what life was about. And really, I stayed up late playing Pinochle with my peers and talking philosophy. So I think my mom died believing that I partied in college, even though I told her multiple times that that was not the case. She wanted to stick to her story. Anyway, ended up moving to California. I lived with my grandmother and an aunt and uncle for a while. I met my ex-husband there. I met my ex-husband at an 11-11 meditation meeting. He and I had a lot in common, I thought. He was 17 years older than I am, so I'm not sure what a 22-year-old can really have in common with a 39-year-old, to be honest, looking at it from this perspective. But he accepted more of me than anyone had to that time in my life, and his beliefs and philosophy were much like mine. We ended up the whole time we were together 20 years. We lived at the fringe of society And he was really kind of an exponential version of my mom. So he was also super controlling, and he was much more extreme than my mom. He wanted the six of us to move through the world as a single unit. He didn't want the kids, excuse me, he didn't want the kids in school. He didn't want them doing extracurricular activities. I tried many times to do both of those things, but he didn't want any part of that because that infringed upon his freedom. And he impinged upon all the rest of our freedom in so many ways. I think the thing that brought me to him was the spiritual facade that he had. He talked the talk, but was never able to walk the walk. His false self, I believe, is still ruling his life. Everything that he's got's all in his head. He doesn't actually live it. I don't actually know what's going on with him except little tidbits from the kids, because he has not spoken to me since we divorced. The day that we divorced, well, the day that we separated, which was 9 months before we divorced, and that was almost 13 years ago now. Yeah, over 13 years. He said to me, "You ruined my life because I left." Because he lived for me and the kids. He didn't have his own identity. That was it, it's I have a lot of sadness, and I've actually spent time in probably the last 6 months really mourning the loss of 20 years of my life with him and being with somebody that was that disconnected. And that mirrored what I was in those 20 years also, in many ways. I think, well, I know I gave up my youth to him, and I also got to have four beautiful children with him. And I'm grateful to have really beautiful relationships with three out of four at this point. So that's good news. About 5 years after I left the marriage, I got into a domestic violence program because a friend of mine said, "Hey, your ex sounds like my ex. It's DV." I'm like, "What?" I had no idea. I honestly had no clue. And when I got in that group, I realized that my family was dysfunctional as well. I knew I didn't like my mom, but I didn't realize it was abusive, and dangerous, and that my childhood was really stolen. And I didn't realize any of that. And that's come, from years way later. So I'm going to roll back just a little bit. Before I met my ex-husband back in the late 80s, I actually started recovery. I went to my first personal growth seminars. My recovery doesn't look like everybody else's. It's unique to me. And sometimes I judge that. One of my parts is a judge, also called the critical parent. And sometimes I've called that critical parent my mom, because my mom was a very critical parent. And I'm recognizing that by calling my inner critical parent my mom, it was another form of dissociation. And so the layers of this work are absolutely incredible. Anyway, my recovery began in the late 80s. I did PSY seminars, which is akin to Landmark or EST. I also did John Gray seminars back in the day, and I did my first 12-step. I dabbled in my first 12-step programs back in those years. Then, fast forward to 2014 after divorce. I divorced in 2012, separated 2011. But 2014, 15, I started 2015, spring of 2015, I started a coaching program. Became a certified life coach. I did my coaching program. That was a 6-month program. And then I was closely associated with the next three because I was like, I gotta get this stuff. Like, I knew that I wanted to do the work. Like, I was actually at that point really ready. Back in the 80s, when I had done that initial work, it was more like gathering tools and planting seeds, but there was no, the soil wasn't healthy enough for anything to grow at that point. But it did keep me thinking and open-minded enough to my true self and wanting to be who I came here to be. So, my coaching program was amazing. It was a cult, and luckily, I wasn't affected by the cult piece as many of the other people involved were. I was able to walk away with the best pieces and leave the rest. I was not their ideal, candidate because I didn't have the kind of money that they wanted. Membership in their organization was 55,000 a year, and I'd come from a life with my husband where we lived in abject poverty. One of the things that happened in my marriage was, and that I found out in the domestic violence intake, was that there was such a thing as financial abuse. I had no idea. With four children, with six of us, a household of six, I don't think there was one year in the 20 years we were together we made more than $10,000 a year. I don't know how we did it. I became, I guess what I can say, the way we did it is I became a master of poverty, and I was able to find solutions in magical ways and give my kids things and opportunities that few had. I mean, if you looked at how I dressed, you wouldn't have ever known that most of my clothes came from thrift stores and the kids too. Luckily, my older two girls were only 15 months apart, so one's clothes went straight to the other one. But it was a challenging thing, and I can say now that being poor actually saved me in certain instances, in probably a lot of instances throughout my life that would have where I would have gotten wrapped into things that I actually didn't want. So I can look at the things that I really kind of disdain about my life as gifts today. So I'm grateful for that. I can say that in 30 years, since the late 80s, when I first started recovery stuff, I dabbled with four different 12-step programs, but none of them really landed for me. I did Debtors Anonymous at 19 because I was living with an aunt and I had a $10,000 credit card debt. And she's like, well, if you're going to live with me, you have to go to DA. So that was kind of a forced thing that was kind of strange. I did go to SLAA on my own. I only did that once because that first time I had a memory that I didn't like and was able to kind of twisted into an okay sort of thing. And so I just kind of pushed that under the rug. Later years, I went into UA. So I wasn't making enough money coming out of my marriage. That was a pattern of my life. And then while I was doing my coaching program, my oldest daughter was in AA and asked me to go to Al-Anon. And so I went. But never did I work the steps or have a sponsor. And even with all that, I did 5 years the DV program, and we did group work and private counseling as well. And in that time period, my life was actually pretty good. I had a couple jobs. I actually rebuilt relationships with my kids. I had time with my grandson in that period of time where I was watching him 3 days a week, and he and I bonded. It was really a beautiful gift. So really, my life was good. Oh, and I lived with a few roommates, a couple roommates, and they were the best roommates. I had some bad roommates, but the last roommates I had were actually really good roommates, and we were offering events in the community. And so I was pretty well respected in the community, and I was feeling good about myself. And that was about the time COVID happened. COVID happened about 6 months in. Our landlords decided they weren't going to renew our lease. I looked all over Santa Fe, which is where I was living, and still the place that I call the home of my heart. I've moved like 50 times in my life, but 18 of those years were in Santa Fe, so I have many communities there, and I love the vibration there. I love the people there. I love the depth of connection with the earth there. I love praying in Sweat Lodge that I did there. I've done there for 25 years. Anyway, I looked all over Santa Fe for a new house, a new place to live. I looked for a one bedroom, a two bedroom, a three bedroom with myself, with the roommates, with one of the roommates. Anyway, we looked all over. None of us could find anything. People from California and the bigger cities had all moved to Santa Fe because Santa Fe was kind of a small town, but has a really kind of cool feel to it. Anyway, when I was feeling kind of up against a wall with housing, I'd remembered that my second daughter, the one with the two baby girl babies, had said, "Hey, Mama, I'd like you to consider living nearby so that when I have babies, you'll be around." And I was like, "Woohoo! I made it!" When she said that, you know, I felt like I'd gotten where I wanted to be in my life. Like I could die that day, you know, because I knew I had repaired relationships, and I'd really, that was kind of my legacy at that moment in time. But she lived in Denver. And that was where I'd grown up, and I never wanted to go back there. So I prayed for 2 or 3, maybe 4 days, prayed and meditated and said, okay, do I stay in Santa Fe and, you know, push through this thing that appears to be brick walls everywhere I'm turning, or do I go to Denver? And after a few days of prayer and meditation, when I looked at staying in Santa Fe, my path was gray and dark. Kind of flat. And when I looked at my path of moving up to Denver, it was bright and sparkly. And I was like, well, it doesn't get any clearer than that. So I packed up a 15-foot U-Haul and put my car behind it on a trailer, and off to Denver I went. And the first year in Denver with my family, my mom, dad, sister were all living under one roof. Two of my four kids were there. And that first year was like a honeymoon phase with my family. Everyone was happy to see me because I really had been mostly estranged from my family most of my life. I kept my distance. I didn't want my kids near my parents because I didn't want them to have the experience I had. And what I realized later, more recently, is that my mom treated the grandbabies differently than she treated me. And it was actually a disservice for me to keep my kids from my mom and dad. Anyway, live and learn. I certainly don't treat my grandkids the way I treated my kids either. And I think that's just the natural cycle of life. Anyway, when my daughter got pregnant, all the shit just hit the fan. She told me that I had to get the vaccine. And the truth of the matter is, I'd never vaccinated any of my children when they were growing up. We kind of lived at the fringe of society. We homeschooled. We lived in Airstreams, tiny homes. So we did all those things way before either of those things were things. And I was praying and meditating about it. And every day I'd ask, can I do this? And every day I got a no inside my body. And I thought that she stopped talking to me because I wouldn't do that. And what I found out years later was that she stopped talking to me because she'd threatened me and I'd reacted. She'd threatened me and said, well, if you don't do this thing, you're not going to be able to be around me and the baby. And I made a comment to her that was not nice. I said something to the effect of, you're going to be I can't believe you're bringing your children into fear like this. And really, it's just a belief. Everyone gets to do as they choose. And it didn't mean that I would necessarily have to be away from my daughter and grandbaby for a long time, but until, a couple months, 2, 3 months, until my daughter decided that things were safe or whatever. But it was my nasty comment about her parenting before she was a parent that caused the rift between us. And with that rift, all my kids stopped talking to me again, and my mom stopped talking to me also. Except she kept a little thread of connection with me because it was more important to look good. So she had to keep the connection with me to look good in her own mind. She couldn't throw me out, but I felt like a leper that could only be seen behind closed door on the rare occasion. Anyway, after a year and a half of dealing with the rejection of my family, that's when I found ACA. And I'm very grateful that I found ACA. I knew after the coaching program and the DV work and the things that I'd done through the years that recovery really only happens for me well in community. And so I had a coaching client at the time, and she mentioned ACA a few times to me. And the third time she mentioned it, I'm like, I'm going. So off to ACA I go. And I thought when I got to ACA, I heard it and I was like, oh my gosh, I am home. I knew I was in my place and I wanted to do it right. My perfectionism was out. And I was like, well, I've never worked any other program before. I'm getting a sponsor and I'm working the steps. I tried a couple sponsors. It did not work for me. And what I realized is that the power and control dynamics were one of the biggest issues of my life. And to have that in a sponsor-sponsee relationship did not work. So I ended up doing the 12 steps in a small book study group. We started with seven of us. We ended with three. It took about a year to actually get through that book. And then after I did that, I started the traits book, and I'm not done with that yet. I'm about 8 months in, and about eight traits in. I say about because I came into the group on trait 12. And we're now on trait six. So I'm doing it in a funny way, but it's working. And with the traits, they don't have to actually be in order like the steps. So I'm finding the traits workbook to be deeper for me than the steps and more revealing, shall I say. I'm learning to use the steps in my day-to-day life more, and that's a practice that's gonna take years. It's not a one and done kind of thing for me. And I also have started the Loving Parent Guidebook in July, and I'm doing that one-on-one with a fellow traveler. We're going at a slower pace than I'm comfortable with. Or we start, let me rephrase that. We started at a slower pace than I'm comfortable with because we are going through one paragraph and sharing. So they'd share their comments, I'd share my comments, and we'd both comment on each other's comments. So it was a really slow process. So about a month ago, maybe two, I don't know how long ago, sometime in the last month, I said, this is too slow. So we're reading a section at a time instead, and that feels better. So we'll see how that goes. Besides the workbooks, which I think are amazing, the other tools of ACA that are very important to me are meetings and service. I've been on two meetings. I've been on service teams for two meetings for 2.5 years apiece, And I was also the co-chair for the ACA Retreat in the Pines last year. I will be on the committee for that again this year. I think service is great because it's kind of like jumping in with our families and having a place to do the work together with everyone committed to actually saying the hard things. Though it's easier said than done sometimes, and it's important for me to remember the traditions, especially the principles over personalities. I would say that my ACA recovery program is like sevenfold, and there's seven parts of my program that are really important. Working the 12 steps, working the traits, working with my parts and building relationships with all my parts, doing service, integration, and grieving. And in the last probably 6, 8 months, the grieving that I've done has been huge. It's been about so many different areas. I spoke about my ex-husband. I've also grieved about my father. My father's still alive, but I realized that I was holding on to a notion that he was somebody that he's not. And I held on to that. I think when my mom died, it was a relief because I grieved the loss of our relationship for so many years that when she died, it was just like this big sigh of relief. And I actually felt like there was room in the world for me to be for the first time ever. And part of me even feels like maybe she left early in life to give me room. And maybe that was a gift. And I say that way because my mom was so controlling. For years, she'd told everybody that she was gonna, there wasn't, she said, there's really no reason to live much past 80. And she died less than 2 months from her 80th birthday. And she died exactly in her way. She got pancreatic cancer at the end of March and died the beginning of June. So it was very quick. She didn't want to do chemo or radiation or any of that. And she didn't want to die at home. And the hospice van came for her, and she'd been waiting all day, and she was in and out of consciousness. She wasn't very lucid. She was definitely on her way out. But she waited because she'd made an agreement with herself that she wasn't going to die at home. And that hospice ambulance came, got her. She recognized my dad was in the van with her, or the ambulance, or whatever you want to call it. He was in it with her, and she knew when she drove into the hospital or the hospice parking lot. And literally, she wasn't at hospice more than 5 minutes before she was gone. My sister and I didn't even get back to the room before she was gone. By the time we got there, she was already gone. Anyway, this woman was very much in control of her life. So I'm realizing more and more as time goes how much control I've tried to have in my own life and how much of a controller I was. I always thought that I was easygoing, laid back. And I keep finding more layers and ways that I've controlled. And one of the ways that I control is by not taking responsibility. And it's not very clean and clear. And what I mean by not taking responsibility is I'd rather give my power away to others than to say what I want to say because I'm afraid of being abandoned. So one of the tools that I learned in my coaching program was how to listen from the inside out to my inner yes and no. And I've carried that forward into my life. Well, that was one of the big tools that I got from my coaching program. And I actually learned how to feel. It was a somatic practice. And I learned to listen and feel the sensations in my body. And the feeling the sensations in my body actually was the key for me being able to find and feel my emotions again. Because I was numb and I went from numb to feeling something, from feeling something to being able to differentiate positive and negative, and then eventually being able to feel the minutia, not the minutia, the variety of feelings that we have. I didn't think I had guilt or shame or anxiety or fear. I didn't think I had any of those because I was numb and I didn't know. And the somatic practice taught me to listen. I could feel maybe like warm honey dripping down my right cheek, or a wave of tingles moving up my left leg or through my abdomen, or all kinds of crazy sensations. But by simply being able to learn to identify those sensations, I believe what happened is that acknowledgement of the sensation in my body was what I needed to allow flow in that area of my life. And then I could, those body memories started moving, and then I could begin to process them. That's how it's worked for me. I don't know how it works for anybody else. And in that, I lost my place. Some body sensations. I don't know where I was going with that. Oh, yes, no. Oh, yes, no. So back to yes, no, and learning to feel. So I learned to feel, and I also learned yes, no. So there's two kinds of feeling that I've discovered. One is that intuitive knowingness, and one is the emotions of life and being human. So the feeling and feeling any of it all kind of gets shut down. It's not one or the other for me. When I stopped feeling, I shut down all of those things. So that I don't know how to describe, I'm going to try and describe it. So feelings for me, the emotions, the happy, the sad, the anger, the grief, the joy, the pleasure, the disappointment, like all of those feelings, that's what being human means to me. And then there's that intuitive, I call it the intuitive yes or no. And that, for me to access that, I have to feel my feelings first. If I'm caught in an emotional state, I can't actually access that. And so, what I've learned is that I have to feel my feelings, and then I can process my feelings. And after I've processed my feelings, then I can tap in and make a clear decision about something. I can tap into that intuitive yes or no. And to me, that's the way that my higher power speaks to me. I believe that all sentient beings on the planet have access to that same binary yes, no feeling within. And I think as humans, we've been taught not to listen to that, and we've been taught that we're bigger than all the other animals. And I think for me, what this program is doing is helping me uncover layer after layer. But I want to explain that yes, no thing a little bit more. It's a binary code like computers. Computer programs are all the software is a binary yes, no. There's no in between. It's either on or it's off. And it's the same with electricity. There isn't some part way. It's yes or no. It's on or off. And so I believe I have that inside myself. And when I listen to that, when I'm able to listen to that, that's me following the truth of my higher power and my true self. And so A yes for me is always clean and clear. It's like laser sharp. There's no hesitation with a yes. It's just like yes. A no to me can be equally laser focused, or it can be any hesitation, any question. And really, it's for this moment, because that's all I have. And that's the only place this truth exists is in the now for me. And so, I want to share an example of something that happened with my partner tonight. And I want to say, I have ended my marriage. I was single for 12 years and was scared to death of relationships. In the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, I wanted a relationship, but I wasn't ready until about a year ago. So now I can say I've been in relationship with my partner for a year, and it's the healthiest relationship I've ever encountered. And it's still very bumpy.
5 minutes.
Thank you. And it's still very challenging. So tonight, she asked me a question. She asked if I wanted her to be on the meeting or not. And I went into stories because I was scared to say no, and I didn't listen to my own yes and no. And here's a even funnier piece about this. We're facilitating a workshop tomorrow morning, and the yes no exercise is kind of the hub of the workshop. And I get asked the simple question, and I couldn't give a simple answer because I didn't want to feel abandoned. So she's not on here tonight, and she kind of pinned me in a corner because I was like going all over the place. She said, "Can you just give me a yes or a no?" And then I remembered, it's not a clean, clear yes. So it's a no. And I said, "No, I don't want you here tonight." She said, "Thank you. That's what I wanted." And we're really striving to be honest with one another and to do the work and to listen to our true selves. We have the gift of honoring all of our parts in this relationship, and yet not at the detriment of one another. So, learning to speak up. I mean, I had a car accident, some of you know, back in July, and I totaled my car, and I have a head injury as a result of that accident. And my inner kids were acting out very badly after that accident, and I didn't realize it. And finally, right before the retreat at the beginning of September, she looked at me and she said, I can't have you at the retreat like this with my kids acting out all over the place." And I looked at her and I didn't even realize it was happening. And when I realized it was happening, I set myself up in a way that I could deal with my wild inner parts that were running amok. And what I did is I got a donkey, a little stuffed donkey for my birthday, which was a few days before. And I said, "Okay, donkey. You're in charge of all these emotions and these kids. You get to feel them." And then I have another stuffed animal. I should have brought him, but I didn't. I have a little teddy bear, which is Mama Bear. And my Mama Bear reminded my donkey that she was going to feel all the feelings and take care of the kids. And so I had both of these little representatives of myself in an outward way to help take care of the parts of me that were running amok so that I could actually be present as an adult at the retreat. And it actually worked really well. So, what I can say is, I am very grateful for this program and all of my fellow travelers, all the work. And I'll repeat the 7 pieces that. And I didn't put fellow travelers in there because So many of the things that I do include my fellow travelers that I didn't write it as a separate piece, and yet it is an integral piece to my recovery. So, traits, part work, steps, relationship with my higher power, service, integration, and grieving. And as I'm reading that, I remember that I didn't talk about integration. And so I will conclude with integration. I have to have time to integrate what I'm learning. If I don't take quiet time, downtime, time away from meetings and service, and really focus on my life to see how all these things actually play out in my life, not in program, I can't do it all. Thanks for letting me share, y'all.